Chapter 7. Marvin stood at the end of the bridge corridor. He was not, in fact, a particularly small robot. His silver body gleamed in the dusty sunbeams and shook with the continual barrage which the building was still undergoing. He did, however, look pitifully small as the gigantic black tank rolled to a halt in front of him. The tank examined him with a probe. The probe withdrew. Marvin stood there.
"Out of my way, little robot," growled the tank.
"I'm afraid," said Marvin, "that I've been left here to stop you."
The probe extended again for a quick recheck. It withdrew again.
"You stop me?" roared the tank. "Go on."
"No, really, I have," said Marvin simply.
"What are you armed with?"
roared the tank in disbelief.
"Guess," said Marvin.
The tank's engines rumbled, its gears ground. Molecule-sized electronic relays deep in its microbrain flipped backwards and forwards in consternation.
"Guess?" said the tank.
Zaphod and the as-yet-unnamed man lurched up one corridor, down a second, and along a third. The building continued to rock and judder, and this puzzled Zaphod. If they wanted to blow the building up, why was it taking so long? With difficulty, they reached one of a number of totally anonymous, unmarked doors and heaved at it. With a sudden jolt, it opened and they fell inside. All this way, thought Zaphod, all this trouble, all this not lying on the beach having a wonderful time, and for what? A single chair, a single desk, and a single dirty ashtray in an undecorated office. The desk, apart from a bit of dancing dust and single revolutionary new form of paperclip, was empty. "Where," said Zaphod, "is Zinywhoop?" feeling that his already tenuous grasp of the point of this whole exercise was beginning to slip.
"He's on an intergalactic cruise," said the man.
Zaphod tried to size the man up. Earnest type, he thought, not a barrel of laughs. He probably apportioned a fair whack of his time to running up and down heaving corridors, breaking down doors and making cryptic remarks in empty offices.
"Let me introduce myself," the man said. "My name is Rooster, and this is my towel."
"Hello, Rooster," said Zaphod.
"Hello, towel,"
he added as Rooster held out to him a rather nasty old flowery towel. Not knowing what to do with it, he shook it by the corner. Outside the window, one of the huge, slug-like, gunmetal green spaceships growled past.
"Yes, go on," said Marvin to the huge battle machine. "You'll never guess."
Said the machine, vibrating with unaccustomed thought.
"Laser beams?"
Marvin shook his head solemnly.
"No,"
muttered the machine in its deep, guttural rumble.
"Too obvious! Antimatter ray?"
it hazarded.
"Far too obvious," admonished Marvin.
"Yes,"
grumbled the machine, somewhat abashed.
How about an electron ram?"
This was new to Marvin.
"What's that?" he said.
"One of these,"
said the machine with enthusiasm. From its turret emerged a sharp prong which spat a single lethal blaze of light. Behind Marvin, a wall roared and collapsed as a heap of dust. The dust billowed briefly, then settled.
"No," said Marvin. "Not one of those."
"Good, though, isn't it?"
"Very good," agreed Marvin.
"I know,"
said the Frogstar battle machine after another moment's consideration.
"You must have one of those new Xanthic Restructron destabilized xenon emitters."
"Nice, aren't they?" said Marvin.
"That's what you've got?"
said the machine in considerable awe.
"No," said Marvin.
"Oh,"
said the machine, disappointed.
"Then it must be..."
"You're thinking along the wrong lines," said Marvin. "You're failing to take into account something fairly basic in the relationship between men and robots."
I know,"
said the battle machine.
"Is it..."
It tailed off into thought again.
"Just think," urged Marvin. "They left me, an ordinary, menial robot, to stop you,
a gigantic, heavy-duty battle machine whilst they ran off to save themselves. What do you think they would leave me with?
Ooh, muttered the machine in alarm. Something pretty damn devastating, I should expect.
Expect? Said Marvin. Oh, yes, expect. I'll tell you what they gave me to protect myself with, shall I?
Yes, all right, said the battle machine, bracing itself.
Nothing, said Marvin. There was a dangerous pause.
Nothing?
Roared the battle machine. Nothing at all, intoned Marvin dismally. Not an electronic sausage. The machine heaved about with fury.
Well, doesn't that just take the biscuit?
It roared.
Nothing, eh? I just don't think, do they?
And me, said Marvin in a soft, low voice, with this terrible pain in all the diodes down my left side.
Oh, makes you spit, doesn't it?
Yes, agreed Marvin, with feeling.
Hell, that makes me angry, bellowed the machine. Think I'll smash that wall down.
The electron ram stabbed out another searing blaze of light and took out the wall next to the machine. How do you think I feel? Said Marvin bitterly.
Just ran off and left you, did they?
The machine thundered.
Yes, said Marvin.
I think I'll shoot down their bloody ceiling as well,
raged the tank. It took out the ceiling of the bridge.
That's very impressive, murmured Marvin.
You ain't seen nothing yet,
promised the machine.
I can take out this floor too, no trouble.
It took out the floor too.
Hell's bells!
The machine roared as it plummeted 15 stories and smashed itself to bits on the ground below.
What a depressingly stupid machine, said Marvin, and trudged away.
Chapter 8.
So do we just sit here or what? Said Zaphod angrily. What do these guys out here want?
You, Beeblebrooks, said Rooster. They're going to take you to the Frog Star, the most totally evil world in the galaxy.
Oh yeah? Said Zaphod. They'll have to come and get me first.
They have come and got you, said Rooster.
Look out of the window.
Zaphod looked and gaped.
The ground's going away, he gasped. Where are they taking the ground?
They're taking the building, said Rooster. We're airborne.
Clouds streaked past the office window. Out in the open air again, Zaphod could see the ring of dark green Frogstar fighters round the uprooted tower of the building. A network of force beams radiated in from them and held the tower in a firm grip. Zaphod shook his head in perplexity.
What have I done to deserve this?
He said.
I walk into a building, they take it away.
It's not what you've done they're worried about, said Rooster. It's what you're going to do.
Well, don't I get a say in that?
You did, years ago.
You'd better hold on. We're in for a fast and bumpy journey.
If I ever meet myself, said Zaphod, I'll hit myself so hard I won't know what's hit me.
Marvin trudged in through the door, looked at Zaphod accusingly, slumped in a corner, and switched himself off. On the bridge of the Heart of Gold, all was silent. Arthur stared at the rack in front of him and thought. He caught Trillian's eyes as she looked at him inquiringly. He looked back at the rack. Finally, he saw it. He picked up 5 small plastic squares and laid them on the board that lay just in front of the rack. The 5 squares had on them the 5 letters E, X, Q, U, and I. He laid them next to the letters S, I, T, E.
Exquisite, he said. On a triple word score, scores rather a lot, I'm afraid.
The ship bumped and scattered some of the letters for the nth time. Trillian sighed and started to sort them out again. Up and down the silent corridors echoed Ford Prefect's feet as he stalked the ship, thumping dead instruments. Why did the ship keep shaking, he thought? Why did it rock and sway? Why could he not find out where they were? Where, basically, were they? The left-hand tower of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy offices streaked through interstellar space at a speed never equaled either before or since by any other office block in the universe. In a room, halfway up it, Zaphod Beeblebrox strode angrily. Rooster sat on the edge of the desk, doing some routine towel maintenance.
Hey, where did you say this building was flying to?
Demanded Zaphod.
The Frogstar, said Rooster. The most totally evil place in the universe.
Do they have food there? Said Zaphod. Food? You're going to the Frogstar and you're worried about whether they got food?
Without food, I may not make it to the Frogstar.
Out of the window, they could see nothing but the flickering light of the force beams and vague green streaks which were presumably the distorted shapes of the Frogstar fighters. At this speed, space itself was invisible and indeed unreal.
Here, suck this, said Rooster, offering Zaphod his towel.
Zaphod stared at him as if he expected a cuckoo to leap out of his forehead on a small spring.
It's soaked in nutrients, explained Rooster.
What are you, a messy eater or something? Said Zaphod.
The yellow stripes are high in protein. The green ones have vitamin B and C complexes. The little pink flowers contain wheat germ extract.
Zaphod took and looked at it in amazement.
What are the brown stains? He asked.
Barbecue sauce, said Rooster, for when I get sick of wheat germ. Zaphod sniffed it doubtfully. Even more doubtfully, he sucked a corner. He spat it out again.
Ugh!
He stated.
Yes, said Rooster. When I've had to suck that end, I usually need to suck the other end a bit too.
Why?
Asked Zaphod suspiciously.
What's in that?
Antidepressants, said Rooster.
I've gone right off this towel, you know, said Zaphod, handing it back.
Rooster took it back from him, swung himself off the desk, walked round it, sat in the chair and put his feet up.
Beeblebrox,
he said, sticking his hands behind his head.
Have you any idea what's going to happen to you on the Frogstar?
They're going to feed me,
hazarded Zaphod, hopefully.
Oh, they're going to feed you, said Rooster, into the total perspective vortex.
Zaphod had never heard of this. He believed that he had heard of all the fun things in the galaxy, so he assumed that the total perspective vortex was not fun. He asked Rooster what it was.
Only, said Rooster, the most savage psychic torture a sentient being can undergo.
Zaphod nodded a resigned nod.
So, he said. No food, huh?
Listen, said Rooster urgently. You can kill a man, destroy his body, break his spirit, but only the total perspective vortex can annihilate a man's soul. The treatment lasts seconds, but the effects last the rest of your life.
You ever had a pan-galactic goggle blaster?
Asked Zaphod sharply.
This is worse!
Phew!
Admitted Zaphod, much impressed.
Any idea why these guys might want to do this to me?
He added a moment later.
They believe it will be the best way of destroying you forever. They know what you're after. Could they drop me a note and let me know as well?
You know, said Rooster. You know, Beeblebrox. You want to meet a man who rules the universe.
Can he cook?
Said Zaphod. On reflection, he added,
I doubt if he can.
If he could cook a good meal, he wouldn't worry about the rest of the universe.
I want to meet a cook.
Rooster sighed heavily.
What are you doing here anyway?
Demanded Zaphod.
What's all this got to do with you?
I'm just one of those who planned this thing. Along with Zarni Whoop, along with Yudin Vranks, along with your great-grandfather, along with you, Beeblebrox.
Me?
Yes, you. I was told you had changed. I didn't realise how much. But I am here to do one job. I will do it before I leave you.
What job, man? What are you talking about?
I will do it before I leave you.
Rooster lapsed into an impenetrable silence. Zaphod was terribly glad. Chapter 9. The air around the second planet of the Frogstar system was stale and unwholesome. The dank winds that swept continually over its surface swept over salt flats, dried-up marshland, tangled and rotting vegetation, and the crumbling remains of ruined cities. No life moved across its surface. The ground, like that of many planets in this part of the galaxy, had long been deserted. The howl of the wind was desolate enough as it gusted through the old decaying houses of the cities. It was more desolate as it whipped about the bottoms of the tall black towers that swayed uneasily here and there about the surface of this world. At the top of these towers, lived colonies of large, scraggy, evil-smelling birds, the sole survivors of the civilization that once lived here. The howl of the wind was at its most desolate, however, when it passed over a pimple of a place set in the middle of a wide grey plain on the outskirts of the largest of the abandoned cities. This pimple of a place was the thing that had earned this world the reputation of being the most totally evil place in the galaxy. From without, it was simply a steel dome about 30 feet across. From within, it was something more monstrous than the mind can comprehend. About 100 yards or so away, and separated from it by a pockmarked and blasted stretch of the most barren land imaginable, was what would probably have to be described as a landing pad of sorts. That is to say that scattered over a largish area were the ungainly hulks of 2 or 3 dozen crash-landed buildings. Flitting over and around these buildings was a mind that was waiting for something. The mind directed its attention into the air, and before very long a distant speck appeared, surrounded by a ring of smaller specks. The larger speck was the left-hand tower of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy office building, descending through the stratosphere of Frogstar World B. As it descended, Rooster suddenly broke the long, uncomfortable silence that had grown up between the two men. He stood up and gathered his towel into a bag. He said, "Beeblebrox, I will now do the job I was sent here to do." Zaphod looked up at him from where he was sitting in a corner sharing unspoken thoughts with Marvin. "Yeah?" he said. "The building will shortly be landing. When you leave the building, do not go out of the door," said Rooster. "Go out of the window." "Good luck," he added, and walked out of the door, disappearing from Zaphod's life as mysteriously as he had entered it. Zaphod leapt up and tried the door, but Rooster had already locked it. He shrugged and returned to the corner. 2 minutes later, the building crash-landed amongst the other wreckage. Its escort of Frogstar fighters deactivated their force beams and soared off into the air again, bound for Frogstar World A, an altogether more congenial spot. They never landed on Frogstar World B. No one did. No one ever walked on its surface other than the intended victims of the total perspective vortex. Zaphod was badly shaken by the crash. He lay for a while in the silent, dusty rubble to which most of the room had been reduced. He felt that he was at the lowest ebb he had ever reached in his life. He felt bewildered. He felt lonely. He felt unloved. Eventually, he felt he ought to get whatever it was over with. He looked around the cracked and broken room. The wall had split round the doorframe, and the door hung open. The window, by some miracle, was closed and unbroken. For a while he hesitated. Then he thought that if his strange and recent companion had been through all that he had been through just to tell him what he had told him, then there must be a good reason for it. With Marvin's help, he got the window open. Outside it, the cloud of dust aroused by the crash and the hulks of the other buildings with which this one was surrounded effectively prevented Zaphod from seeing anything of the world outside. Not that this concerned him unduly. His main concern was what he saw when he looked down. Zarniwoop's office was on the 15th floor. The building had landed at a tilt of about 45 degrees, but still the descent looked heart-stopping. Eventually, stung by the continuous series of contemptuous looks that Marvin appeared to be giving him, he took a deep breath and clambered out onto the steeply inclined side of the building. Marvin followed him, and together they began to crawl slowly and painfully down the 15 floors that separated them from the ground. As he crawled, the dank air and dust choked his lungs, his eyes smarted, and the terrifying distance down made his heads spin. The occasional remark from Marvin of the order of, "This is the sort of thing you life forms enjoy, is it? I ask merely for information," did little to improve his state of mind. About halfway down the side of the shattered building, they stopped to rest. It seemed to Zaphod, as he lay there panting with fear and exhaustion, that Marvin seemed a mite more cheerful than usual. Eventually, he realised this wasn't so. The robot just seemed cheerful in comparison with his own mood. A large, scraggy black bird came flapping through the slowly settling clouds of dust and, stretching down its scrawny legs, landed on an inclined window ledge a couple of yards from Zaphod. It folded its ungainly wings and teetered awkwardly on its perch. Its wingspan must have been something like 6 feet, and its head and neck seemed curiously large for a bird. Its face was flat, the beak underdeveloped, and halfway along the underside of its wings, the vestige of something hand-like could be clearly seen. In fact, it looked almost human. It turned its heavy eyes on Zaphod and clicked its beak in a desultory fashion.
"Go away," said Zaphod.
"Okay,"
muttered the bird morosely and flapped off into the dust again. Zaphod watched its departure in bewilderment.
"Did that bird just talk to me?"
he asked Marvin nervously. He was quite prepared to believe the alternative explanation, that he was, in fact, hallucinating.
"Yes," confirmed Marvin.
"Poor souls,"
said a deep, ethereal voice in Zaphod's ear. Twisting round violently to find the source of the voice nearly caused Zaphod to fall off the building. He grabbed savagely at a protruding window fitting and cut his hand on it. He hung on, breathing heavily. The voice had no visible source whatsoever. There was no one there. Nevertheless, it spoke again.
"A tragic history behind them, you know. A terrible blight."
Zaphod looked wildly about. The voice was deep and quiet. In other circumstances, it would even be described as soothing. There is, however, nothing soothing about being addressed by a disembodied voice out of nowhere, particularly when you are, like Zaphod Beeblebrox, not at your best, and hanging from a ledge 8 stories up a crashed building.
Hey,
he stammered.
"Shall I tell you their story?" inquired the voice, quietly.
"Hey, who are you?" panted Zaphod. "Where are you?"
"Later, then, perhaps," murmured the voice. "I am Gargravar. I am the custodian of the Total Perspective Vortex."
"Why can't I see?"
"You will find your progress down the building greatly facilitated," the voice lifted, "if you move about 2 yards to your left. Why don't you try it?"
Zaphod looked and saw a series of short horizontal grooves leading all the way down the side of the building. Gratefully, he shifted himself across to them.
"Why don't I see you again at the bottom?" said the voice in his ear,
and as it spoke, it faded.
Hey,
called out Zaphod.
"Where are you?"
"It'll only take you a couple of minutes,"
said the voice very faintly.
"Marvin,"
said Zaphod earnestly to the robot squatting dejectedly next to him.
Did a voice just..."
"Yes," Marvin replied tersely. Zaphod nodded. He took out his peril-sensitive sunglasses again. They were completely black, and by now quite badly scratched by the unexpected metal object in his pocket. He put them on. He would find his way down the building more comfortably if he didn't actually have to look at what he was doing. Minutes later, he clambered over the ripped and mangled foundations of the building, and once more removing his sunglasses, he dropped to the ground. Marvin joined him a moment or so later and lay face down in the dust and rubble, from which position he seemed disinclined to move.
"Ah, there you are," said the voice suddenly in Zaphod's ear. "Excuse me leaving you like that. It's just that I have a terrible head for heights. At least," it added wistfully, "I did have a terrible head for heights."
Zaphod looked around slowly and carefully, just to see if he had missed something which might be the source of the voice. All he saw, however, was the dust, the rubble, and the towering hulks of the encircling buildings.
Hey, why can't I see you?" he said. "Why aren't you here?"
"I am here," said the voice slowly. "My body wanted to come, but it's a bit busy at the moment. Things to do, people to see."
After what seemed like a sort of ethereal sigh, it added,
"You know how it is with bodies."
Zaphod wasn't sure about this.
"I thought I did," he said.
"I only hope it's gone in for a rest cure," continued the voice. "The way it's been living recently, it must be on its last elbows."
"Elbows,"
said Zaphod.
"Don't you mean last legs?"
The voice said nothing for a while. Zaphod looked around uneasily. He didn't know if it had gone, or was still there, or what it was doing. Then the voice spoke again.
"So, you are to be put into the vortex, yes?"
Well, said Zaphod with a very poor attempt at nonchalance. "This cat's in no hurry, you know. I can just slouch about and take in a look at the local scenery, you know."
Have you seen the local scenery?
Asked the voice of Gargravar.
No.
Zaphod clambered over the rubble and rounded the corner of one of the wrecked buildings that was obscuring his view. He looked out at the landscape of Frogstar World B.
Ah, okay, he said. I'll just sort of slouch about then.
No, said Gargravar. The vortex is ready for you now. You must come. Follow me.
Yeah, said Zaphod. And how am I meant to do that?
I'll hum for you, said Gargravar. Follow the humming.
A soft, keening sound drifted through the air, a pale, sad sound that seemed to be without any kind of focus. It was only by listening very carefully that Zaphod was able to detect the direction from which it was coming. Slowly, dazedly, he stumbled off in its wake. What else was there to do? Chapter 10. The universe, as has been observed before, is an unsettlingly big place, a fact which, for the sake of a quiet life, most people tend to ignore. Many would happily move to somewhere rather smaller of their own devising, and this is what most beings in fact do. For instance, in one corner of the Eastern Galactic Arm lies the large forest planet Oglaroon, the entire intelligent population of which lives permanently in one fairly small and crowded nut tree. In which tree they are born, live, fall in love, carve tiny speculative articles in the bark on the meaning of life, the futility of death and the importance of birth control, fight a few extremely minor wars, and eventually die strapped to the underside of some of the less accessible outer branches. In fact, the only Oglaroonians who ever leave their tree are those who were hurled out of it for the heinous crime of wondering whether any of the other trees might be capable of supporting life at all, or indeed, whether the other trees are anything other than illusions brought on by eating too many oglernuts. Exotic though this behaviour may seem, there is no life form in the galaxy which is not in some way guilty of the same thing, which is why the total perspective vortex is as horrific as it is. For when you are put into the vortex, you are given just one momentary glimpse of the entire, unimaginable infinity of creation, and somewhere in it, a tiny little market, a microscopic dot on a microscopic dot, which says, "You are here." The grey plain stretched before Zaphod, a ruined, shattered plain. The wind whipped wildly over it. Visible in the middle was the steel pimple of the dome. This, gathered Zaphod, was where he was going. This was the total perspective vortex. As he stood and gazed bleakly at it, a sudden inhuman wail of terror emanated from it, as of a man having his soul burnt from his body. It screamed above the wind and died away. Zaphod stared with fear, and his blood seemed to turn to liquid helium.
"Hey, what was that?"
he muttered voicelessly.
"A recording," said Gargravar, "of the last man who was put in the vortex. It is always played to the next victim, a sort of prelude."
"Hey, it really sounds bad," stammered Zaphod. "Couldn't we maybe slope off to a party or something for a while, think it over?"
"For all I know," said Gargravar's ethereal voice, "I'm probably at one. My body, that is. It goes to a lot of parties without me. Says I only get in the way. Hey-ho."
"What is all this with your body?"
said Zaphod, anxious to delay whatever it was that was going to happen to him.
"Well, it's busy, you know," said Gargravar hesitantly.
"You mean it's got a mind of its own?" said Zaphod.
There was a long and slightly chilly pause before Gargravar spoke again.
"I have to say," he replied eventually, "that I find that remark in rather poor taste."
Zaphod muttered a bewildered and embarrassed apology.
"No matter," said Gargravar. "You weren't to know."
The voice fluttered unhappily.
"The truth is,"
it continued in tones which suggested he was trying very hard to keep it under control,
"the truth is that we are currently undergoing a period of legal trial separation. I suspect it will end in divorce."
The voice was still again, leaving Zaphod with no idea of what to say. He mumbled uncertainly.
"I think we were probably not very well suited," said Gargravar again at length.
We never seemed to be happy doing the same things. We always had the greatest arguments over sex and fishing. Eventually we tried to combine the two, but that only led to disaster, as you can probably imagine. And now my body refuses to let me in. It won't even see me.
He paused again, tragically. The wind whipped across the plain.
It says I only inhibit it. I pointed out that in fact I was meant to inhabit it, and it said that that was exactly the sort of smart-aleck remark that got right up a body's left nostril, and so we left it. It will probably get custody of my forename.
Oh, said Zaphod faintly. And what's that?
Pizpot, said the voice. My name is Pizpot Gargravar. Says it all, really, doesn't it?
Said Zaphod sympathetically.
And that is why I, as a disembodied mind, have this job. Custodian of the Total Perspective Vortex. No one will ever walk on the ground of this planet, except the victims of the vortex. They don't really count, I'm afraid.
Ah.
I'll tell you the story. Would you like to hear it? Many years ago, this was a thriving, happy planet. People, cities, shops, a normal world. Except that on the high streets of these cities, there were slightly more shoe shops than one might have thought necessary. And slowly, insidiously, the numbers of these shoe shops were increasing. It's a well-known economic phenomenon, but tragic to see it in operation, for the more shoe shops there were, the more shoes they had to make, and the worse and more unwearable they became. And the worse they were to wear, the more people had to buy to keep themselves shod, and the more the shops proliferated, until the whole economy of the place passed what I believe is termed the shoe event horizon, and it became no longer economically possible to build anything other than shoe shops. Result? Collapse, ruin, and famine. Most of the population died out. Those few who had the right kind of genetic instability mutated into birds. You've seen one of them, who cursed their feet, cursed the ground, and vowed that none should walk on it again. Unhappy lot. Come, I must take you to the vortex.
Zaphod shook his head in bemusement and stumbled forward across the plain.
And you, he said, you come from this hellhole pit, do you?
No, no, said Gargravar, taken aback. I come from the Frogstar World Sea. Beautiful place, wonderful fishing. I flit back there in the evenings, though all I can do now is watch.
The Total Perspective Vortex is the only thing on this planet with any function. It was built here because no one else wanted it on their doorstep. At that moment, another dismal scream rent the air and Zaphod shuddered.
What can do that to a guy? He breathed.
The universe, said Gargravar simply. The whole infinite universe. The infinite suns, the infinite distances between them, and yourself an invisible dot on an invisible dot, infinitely small.
Hey, I'm Zaphod Beeblebrox, man, you know,
muttered Zaphod, trying to flap the last remnants of his ego. Gargravar made no reply, but merely resumed his mournful humming till they reached the tarnished steel dome in the middle of the plain. As they reached it, a door hummed open in the side, revealing a small darkened chamber within.
Enter, said Gargravar.
Zaphod started with fear.
Hey, what, now?
He said.
Now.
Zaphod peered nervously inside. The chamber was very small. It was steel-lined, and there was hardly space in it for more than one man.
It doesn't look like any kind of vortex to me, said Zaphod.
It isn't, said Gargravar. It's just the elevator. Enter.
With infinite trepidation, Zaphod stepped into it. He was aware of Gargravar being in the elevator with him, though the disembodied man was not for the moment speaking. The elevator began its descent.
I must get myself into the right frame of mind for this, muttered Zaphod.
There is no right frame of mind, said Gargravar sternly.
You really know how to make a guy feel inadequate.
I don't. The vortex does.
At the bottom of the shaft, the rear of the elevator opened up, and Zaphod stumbled out into a smallish, functional, steel-lined chamber. At the far side of it stood a single upright steel box, just large enough for a man to stand in. It was that simple. It connected to a small pile of components and instruments via a single thick wire.
"Is that it?" said Zaphod in surprise. "That is it."
Didn't look too bad, thought Zaphod.
"And I get in there, do I?" said Zaphod. "You get in there," said Gargravar. "And I'm afraid you must do it now."
"Okay, okay," said Zaphod. He opened the door of the box and stepped in. Inside the box, he waited. After 5 seconds, there was a click, and the entire universe was there in the box with him. Chapter 11. The total perspective vortex derives its picture of the whole universe on the principle of extrapolated matter analyses. To explain, since every piece of matter in the universe is in some way affected by every other piece of matter in the universe, it is, in theory, possible to extrapolate the whole of creation, every sun, every planet, their orbits, their composition, and their economic and social history from, say, one small piece of fairy cake. The man who invented the total perspective vortex did so, basically, in order to annoy his wife. Trintragula, for that was his name, was a dreamer, a thinker, a speculative philosopher, or, as his wife would have it, an idiot. And she would nag him incessantly about the utterly inordinate amount of time he spent staring out into space or mulling over the mechanics of safety pins or doing spectrographic analyses of pieces of fairy cake. "Have some sense of proportion," she would say, sometimes as often as 38 times in a single day. And so he built the total perspective vortex, just to show her. And into one end, he plugged the whole of reality as extrapolated from a piece of fairy cake, and into the other end, he plugged his wife. So that when he turned it on, she saw in one instant the whole infinity of creation, and herself in relation to it. To Trintragula's horror, the shock completely annihilated her brain. But to his satisfaction, he realised that he had proved conclusively that if life is going to exist in a universe of this size, then the one thing it cannot afford to have is a sense of proportion. The door of the vortex swung open. From his disembodied mind, Gargravar watched dejectedly. He had rather liked Zaphod Beeblebrox in a strange sort of way. He was clearly a man of many qualities, even if they were mostly bad ones. He waited for him to flop forwards out of the box, as they all did. Instead, he stepped out. "Hi," he said.
"Beeblebrox," gasped Gargravar's mind in amazement.
"Could I have a drink, please?" said Zaphod.
You have been in the vortex," stammered Gargravar.
"You saw me, kid."
"And it was working?"
"Sure was."
"And you saw the whole infinity of creation?"
"Sure. Really neat place, you know that?"
Gargravar's mind was reeling in astonishment. Had his body been with him, it would have sat down heavily with its mouth hanging open.
"And you saw yourself," said Gargravar, "in relation to it all?"
"Oh, yeah, yeah."
"But what did you experience?"
Zaphod shrugged smugly.
"It just told me what I knew all the time. I'm a really terrific and great guy. Didn't I tell you, baby? I'm Zaphod Beeblebrox."
His gaze passed over the machinery which powered the vortex and suddenly stopped, startled. He breathed heavily.
"Hey," he said, "is that really a piece of fairy cake?"
He ripped the small piece of confectionery from the sensors with which it was surrounded.
"If I told you how much I needed this," he said ravenously, "I wouldn't have time to eat it."
He ate it. Chapter 12. A short while later, he was running across the plain in the direction of the ruined city. The dank air wheezed heavily in his lungs, and he frequently stumbled with the exhaustion he was still feeling. Night was beginning to fall too, and the rough ground was treacherous. The elation of his recent experience was still with him, though. The whole universe. He had seen the whole universe stretching to infinity around him. Everything. and with it had come the clear and extraordinary knowledge that he was the most important thing in it. Having a conceited ego is one thing. Actually being told by a machine is another. He didn't have time to reflect on this matter. Gargravar had told him that he would have to alert his masters as to what had happened, but that he was prepared to leave a decent interval before doing so. Enough time for Zaphod to make a break and find somewhere to hide. What he was going to do, he didn't know, but feeling that he was the most important person in the universe gave him the confidence to believe that something would turn up. Nothing else on this blighted planet could give him much grounds for optimism. He ran on, and soon reached the outskirts of the abandoned city. He walked along cracked and gaping roads riddled with scrawny weeds, the holes filled with rotting shoes. The buildings he passed were so crumbled and decrepit he thought it unsafe to enter any of them. Where could he hide? He hurried on. After a while, the remains of a wide sweeping road led off from the one down which he was walking, and at its end lay a vast low building, surrounded with sundry smaller ones, the whole surrounded by the remains of a perimeter barrier. The large main building still seemed reasonably solid, and Zaphod turned off to see if it might provide him with, well, with anything. He approached the building. Along one side of it, the front it would seem, since it faced a wide, concreted apron area, were three gigantic doors, maybe 60 feet high. The far one of these was open, and towards this Zaphod ran. Inside, all was gloom, dust, and confusion. Giant cobwebs lay over everything. Part of the infrastructure of the building had collapsed, part of the rear wall had caved in, and a thick, choking dust lay inches deep over the floor. Through the heavy gloom, huge shapes loomed, covered with debris. The shapes were sometimes cylindrical, sometimes bulbous, sometimes like eggs, or rather cracked eggs. Most of them were split open or falling apart. Some were mere skeletons. They were all spacecraft, all derelict. Zaphod wandered in frustration amongst the hulks. There was nothing here that remotely approached the serviceable. Even the mere vibration of his footsteps caused one precarious wreck to collapse further into itself. Towards the rear of the building lay one old ship, slightly larger than the others, and buried beneath even deeper piles of dust and cobwebs. Its outline, however, seemed unbroken. Zaphod approached it with interest, and as he did so, he tripped over an old feed line. He tried to toss the feed line aside, and to his surprise, discovered that it was still connected to the ship. To his utter astonishment, he realised that the feed line was also humming slightly. He stared at the ship in disbelief, and then back down at the feed line in his hands. He tore off his jacket and threw it aside. Crawling along on his hands and knees, he followed the feed line to the point where it connected with the ship. The connection was sound, and the slight humming vibration was more distinct. His heart was beating fast. He wiped away some grime and laid an ear against the ship's side. He could hear only a faint, indeterminate noise. He rummaged feverishly amongst the debris lying on the floor all about him and found a short length of tubing and a non-biodegradable plastic cup. Out of this he fashioned a crude stethoscope and placed it against the side of the ship. What he heard made his brains turn somersaults. The voice said,
"Transstellar Cruise Lines would like to apologise to passengers for the continuing delay to this flight. We are currently awaiting the loading of our complement of small lemon-soaked paper napkins for your comfort, refreshment and hygiene during the journey. Meanwhile, we thank you for your patience. The cabin crew will shortly be serving coffee and biscuits again."
Zaphod staggered backwards, staring wildly at the ship. He walked around for a few moments in a daze. In so doing, he suddenly caught sight of a giant departure board still hanging, but by only one support from the ceiling above him. It was covered with grime, but some of the figures were still discernible. Zaphod's eyes searched amongst the figures, then made some brief calculations. His eyes widened.
900 years? He breathed to himself.
That was how late the ship was. 2 minutes later, he was on board. As he stepped out of the airlock, the air that greeted him was cool and fresh. The air conditioning was still working. The lights were still on. He moved out of the small entrance chamber into a short, narrow corridor and stepped nervously down it. Suddenly, a door opened and a figure stepped out in front of him.
"Please return to your seat, sir,"
said the android stewardess, and, turning her back on him, she walked on down the corridor in front of him. When his heart had started beating again, he followed her. She opened the door at the end of the corridor and walked through. He followed her through the door. They were now in the passenger compartment, and Zaphod's heart stopped still again for a moment. In every seat sat a passenger, strapped into his or her seat. The passengers' hair was long and unkempt, their fingernails were long, the men wore beards. All of them were quite clearly alive, but sleeping. Zaphod had the creeping horrors. He walked slowly down the aisle as in a dream. By the time he was halfway down the aisle, the stewardess had reached the other end. She turned and spoke.
"Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen," she said sweetly. "Thank you for bearing with us during this slight delay. We'll be taking off as soon as we possibly can. If you would like to wake up now, I will serve you coffee and biscuits."
There was a slight hum. At that moment, all the passengers awoke. They awoke screaming and clawing at the straps and life support systems that held them tightly in their seats. They screamed and bawled and hollered till Zaphod thought his ears would shatter. They struggled and writhed as the stewardess patiently moved up the aisle, placing a small cup of coffee and a packet of biscuits in front of each one of them. Then one of them rose from his seat. He turned and looked at Zaphod. Zaphod's skin was crawling all over his body as if it was trying to get off. He turned and ran from the bedlam. He plunged through the door and back into the corridor. The man pursued him. He raced in a frenzy to the end of the corridor, through the entrance chamber and beyond. He arrived on the flight deck, slammed and bolted the door behind him. He leant back against the door, breathing hard. Within seconds, a hand started beating on the door. From somewhere on the flight deck, a metallic voice addressed him. "Passengers are not allowed on the flight deck. Please return to your seat and wait for the ship to take off. Coffee and biscuits are being served. This is your autopilot speaking. Please return to your seat." Zaphod said nothing. He breathed hard. Behind him, the hand continued to knock on the door. "Please return to your seat," repeated the autopilot. "Passengers are not allowed on the flight deck."
"I'm not a passenger," panted Zaphod.
"Please return to your seat."
"I am not a passenger," shouted Zaphod again. "Please return to your seat." "I am not a... Hello, can you hear me?"
"Please return to your seat."
"You're the autopilot?"
said Zaphod.
"Yes,"
said the voice from the flight console.
"You're in charge of this ship?"
"Yes," said the voice again. "There has been a delay. Passengers are to be kept temporarily in suspended animation for their comfort and convenience. Coffee and biscuits are served every year, after which passengers are returned to suspended animation for their continued comfort and convenience. Departure will take place when the flight stores are complete. We apologise for the delay." Zaphod moved away from the door, on which the pounding had now ceased. He approached the flight console.
"Delay?" he cried. "Have you seen the world outside this ship? It's a wasteland, a desert. Civilization's been and gone, man. There are no lemon-soaked paper napkins on the way from anywhere."
"The statistical likelihood," continued the autopilot primly, "is that other civilizations will arise. There will one day be lemon-soaked paper napkins. Till then, there will be a short delay. Please return to your seat."
"But..."
But at that moment, the door opened. Zaphod span round to see the man who had pursued him standing there. He carried a large briefcase. He was smartly dressed, and his hair was short. He had no beard and no long fingernails.
"Zaphod Beeblebrox," he said. "My name is Zarniwoop. I believe you wanted to see me."
Zaphod Beeblebrox whittered. His mouths said foolish things. He dropped into a chair.
"Oh, man. Oh, man. Where did you spring from?" he said.
"I've been waiting here for you,"
he said in a businesslike tone. He put the briefcase down and sat in another chair.
"I'm glad you followed instructions," he said. "I was a bit nervous that you might have left my office by the door rather than the window. Then you would have been in trouble."
Zaphod shook his head at him and burbled.
"When you entered the door of my office, you entered my electronically synthesized universe," he explained. "If you had left by the door, you would have been back in the real one. The artificial one works from here."
He patted the briefcase smugly. Zaphod glared at him with resentment and loathing.
"What's the difference?" he muttered.
"Nothing," said Zarniwoop. "They are identical.
Oh, except that I think the Frog Starfighters are grey in the real universe.
What's going on? Spat Zaphod.
Simple, said Zarniwoop. His self-assurance and smugness made Zaphod seethe. Very simple, repeated Zarniwoop. I discovered the coordinates at which this man could be found, the man who rules the universe, and discovered that his world was protected by an improbability field. To protect my secret, and myself, I retreated to the safety of this totally artificial universe and hid myself away in a forgotten cruise liner. I was secure. Meanwhile, you and I...
You and I? Said Zaphod angrily. You mean I knew you?
Yes, said Zarniwoop. We knew each other well.
I had no taste, said Zaphod, and resumed a sullen silence.
Meanwhile, you and I arranged that you would steal the improbability drive ship, the only one which could reach the ruler's world, and bring it to me here. This you have now done, I trust, and I congratulate you.
He smiled a tight little smile, which Zaphod wanted to hit with a brick.
Oh, and in case you were wondering, added Zarniwoop, this universe was created specifically for you to come to. You are therefore the most important person in this universe. You would never, he said with an even more brickable smile, have survived the total perspective vortex in the real one. Shall we go?
Where?
Said Zaphod sullenly. He felt collapsed.
To your ship, the Heart of Gold. You did bring it, I trust.
No.
Where is your jacket?
Zaphod looked at him in mystification.
My jacket? I took it off. It's outside.
Good. We will go and find it.
Zarniwoop stood up and gestured to Zaphod to follow him. Out in the entrance chamber again, they could hear the screams of the passengers being fed coffee and biscuits.
It has not been a pleasant experience waiting for you, said Zarniwoop.
Not pleasant for you, bawled Zaphod. How do you think...
Zarniwoop held up a silencing finger as the hatchway swung open. A few feet away from them, they could see Zaphod's jacket lying in the debris.
A very remarkable and very powerful ship, said Zarniwoop. Watch.
As they watched, the pocket on the jacket suddenly bulged. It split. It ripped. The small metal model of the Heart of Gold that Zaphod had been bewildered to discover in his pocket was growing. It grew. It continued to grow. It reached, after 2 minutes, its full size.
At an improbability level, said Zarniwoop, of, oh, I don't know, but something very large.
Zaphod swayed.
You mean I had it with me all the time?
Zarniwoop smiled. He lifted up his briefcase and opened it. He twisted a single switch inside it.
Goodbye, artificial universe, he said. Hello, real one.
The scene before them shimmered briefly and reappeared exactly as before.
You see, said Zarniwoop, exactly the same.
You mean, repeated Zaphod tautly, that I had it with me all the time?
Oh, yes, said Zarniwoop. Of course, that was the whole point.
That's it, said Zaphod. You can count me out. From here on in, you can count me out. I've had all I want of this. You play your own games.
I'm afraid you cannot leave, said Zarniwoop. You're entwined in the improbability field. You cannot escape.
He smiled the smile that Zaphod had wanted to hit, and this time, Zaphod hit it. Chapter 13. Ford Prefect bounded up to the bridge of the Heart of Gold.
Trillian! Arthur! He shouted. It's working! The ship's reactivated!
Trillian and Arthur were asleep on the floor.
Come on, you guys! We're going! We're off!
He said, kicking them awake.
Hi there, guys! Twittered the computer. It's really great to be back with you again, I can tell you. And I just want to say that...
Shut up, said Ford. And tell us where the hell we are.
Frogstar World B, and man, it's a dump, said Zaphod, running onto the bridge. Hi, guys, you must be so amazingly glad to see me you can't even find words to tell me what a cool fruit I am.
What a what? Said Arthur, blearily, picking himself up from the floor and not taking any of this in.
I know how you feel, said Zaphod.
I'm so great even I get tongue-tied talking to myself.
Hey, it's good to see you, Trillian, Ford, Monkey Man.
Hey, computer? Hi there, Mr. Beeblebrox, sir. Sure is a great honor to... Shut up! And get us out of here fast, fast, fast! Sure thing, fella. Where do you want to go?
Anywhere. Doesn't matter, shouted Zaphod. Yes, it does, he said again. We want to go to the nearest place to eat.
Sure thing, said the computer happily, and a massive explosion rocked the bridge.
When Zarniwoop entered a minute or so later with a black eye, he regarded the four wisps of smoke with interest. Chapter 14. Four inert bodies sank through spinning blackness. Consciousness had died. Cold oblivion pulled the bodies down and down into the pit of unbeing. The roar of silence echoed dismally around them, and they sank at last into a dark and bitter sea of heaving red that slowly engulfed them, seemingly forever. After what seemed an eternity, the seas receded and left them lying on a cold, hard shore, the flotsam and jetsam of the stream of life, the universe, and everything. Cold spasms shook them. Lights danced sickeningly around them. The cold, hard shore tipped and span and then stood still. It shone darkly. It was a very highly polished cold, hard shore. A green blur watched them disapprovingly. It coughed.
Good evening, madam, gentlemen, it said. Do you have a reservation?
Ford Prefect's consciousness snapped back like elastic, making his brain smart. He looked up woozily at the green blur.
Reservation? He said weakly. Yes, sir, said the green blur. Do you need a reservation for the afterlife?
In so far as it is possible for a green blur to arch its eyebrows disdainfully, this is what the green blur now did.
Afterlife, sir, it said.
Arthur Dent was grappling with his consciousness the way one grapples with a lost bar of soap in the bath.
Is this the afterlife? He stammered.
Well, I assume so, said Ford Prefect, trying to work out which way was up. He tested the theory that it must lie in the opposite direction from the cold, hard shore on which he was lying, and staggered to what he hoped were his feet.
I mean, he said, swaying gently, there's no way we could have survived that blast, is there?
No, muttered Arthur. He had raised himself onto his elbows, but it didn't seem to improve things. He slumped down again.
No, said Trillian, standing up. No way at all.
A dull, hoarse, gurgling sound came from the floor. It was Zaphod Beeblebrox attempting to speak.
I certainly didn't survive, he gurgled. I was a total goner. Wham, bang, and that was it.
Yeah, thanks to you, said Ford. We didn't stand a chance. We must have been blown to bits, arms, legs, everywhere.
Yeah,
said Zaphod, struggling noisily to his feet.
If the lady and gentleman would care to order drinks,
said the green blur, hovering impatiently beside them.
Kapow! Splat! Continued Zaphod. Instantaneously zonked into our component molecules. Hey, Ford,
he said, identifying one of the slowly solidifying blurs around him.
Did you get that thing of your whole life flashing before you?
You got that too, said Ford. Your whole life?
Yeah, said Zaphod. At least I assume it was mine. I spent a lot of time out of my skulls, you know.
He looked around him at the various shapes that were at last becoming proper shapes, instead of vague and wobbling, shapeless shapes.
So?
He said. So what? Said Ford.
So here we are, said Zaphod hesitantly. Lying dead.
Standing, Trillian corrected him.
Ah, standing dead, continued Zaphod, in this desolate
restaurant, said Arthur Dent, who had got to his feet and could now, much to his surprise, see clearly. That is to say, the thing that surprised him was not that he could see, but what he could see.
Here we are, continued Zaphod doggedly, standing dead in this desolate
five-star, said Trillian.
Restaurant, concluded Zaphod.
Odd, isn't it? Said Ford.
Yeah.
Nice chandeliers, though, said Trillian.
They looked about themselves in bemusement.
It's not so much an afterlife, said Arthur, more a sort of après-vie.
The chandeliers were, in fact, a little on the flashy side, and the low vaulted ceiling from which they hung would not, in an ideal universe, have been painted in that particular shade of deep turquoise, and even if it had been, it wouldn't have been highlighted by concealed mood lighting. This is not, however, an ideal universe, as was further evidenced by the eye-crossing patterns of the inlaid marble floor and the way in which the fronting for the 80-yard-long marble-topped bar had been made. The fronting for the 80-yard-long marble-topped bar had been made by stitching together nearly 20,000 Antarean mosaic lizard skins, despite the fact that the 20,000 lizards concerned had needed them to keep their insides in. A few smartly dressed creatures were lounging casually at the bar, or relaxing in the richly coloured body-hugging seats that were deployed here and there about the bar area. A young Vlerg officer and his green steaming young lady passed through the large smoked glass doors at the far end of the bar into the dazzling light of the main body of the restaurant beyond. Behind Arthur was a large curtained bay window. He pulled aside the corner of the curtain and looked out at a bleak and drear landscape, grey, pockmarked and dismal. A landscape which, under normal circumstances, would have given Arthur the creeping horrors. These were not, however, normal circumstances. For the thing that froze his blood and made his skin try to crawl up his back and off the top of his head was the sky. The sky was... An attendant flunky politely drew the curtain back into place.
"All in good time, sir," he said.
Zaphod's eyes flashed.
"Hey, hang about, you dead guys," he said. "I think we're missing some ultra-important thing here, you know. Something somebody said, and we missed it."
Arthur was profoundly relieved to turn his attention from what he had just seen. He said, "I said it was a sort of apparate..."
"Yeah, and don't you wish you hadn't," said Zaphod. "Ford?"
"I said it was odd."
"Yeah, shrewd but dull, perhaps it was."
"Perhaps," interrupted the green blur, who had by this time resolved into the shape of a small, wizened, dark-suited green waiter, "perhaps you would care to discuss the matter over drinks."
"Drinks!" cried Zaphod. "That was it! See what you miss if you don't stay alert."
"Indeed, sir," said the waiter patiently, "if the lady and gentleman would care to take drinks before dinner."
"Dinner!"
Zaphod exclaimed with passion.
"Listen, little green person, my stomach could take you home and cuddle you all night for the mere idea."
"And the universe," continued the waiter, determined not to be deflected on his home stretch, "will explode later for your pleasure." Ford's head swiveled slowly towards him. He spoke with feeling.
"Wow," he said. "What sort of drinks do you serve in this place?"
The waiter laughed a polite little waiter's laugh. "Ha ha," he said. "I think sir has perhaps misunderstood me."
"Oh, I hope not," breathed Ford.
The waiter coughed a polite little waiter's cough. "It is not unusual for our customers to be a little disorientated by the time journey," he said, "so if I might suggest..."
"Time journey?"
said Zaphod.
"Time journey?" said Ford.
"Time journey?" said Trillian.
"You mean this isn't the afterlife?" said Arthur.
The waiter smiled a polite little waiter's smile. He had almost exhausted his polite little waiter repertoire, and would soon be slipping into his role of a rather tight-lipped and sarcastic little waiter.
"Afterlife, sir," he said. "No, sir."
"And we're not dead," said Arthur. The waiter tightened his lips.
"Aha, ha," he said. "Sir is most evidently alive, otherwise I would not attempt to serve, sir."
In an extraordinary gesture, which it is pointless attempting to describe, Zaphod Beeblebrox slapped both his foreheads with two of his arms and one of his thighs with the other.
"Hey, guys," he said, "this is crazy. We did it. We finally got to where we were going. This is Milliways."
"Milliways?" said Ford.
"Yes, sir," said the waiter, laying on the patience with a trowel. "This is Milliways, the restaurant at the end of the universe."
"End of what?" said Arthur.
"The universe," repeated the waiter, very clearly and unnecessarily distinctly.
"When did that end?"
said Arthur.
"In just a few minutes, sir," said the waiter.
He took a deep breath. He didn't need to do this, since his body was supplied with the peculiar assortment of gases it required for survival from a small intravenous device strapped to his leg. There are times, however, when, whatever your metabolism, you have to take a deep breath. "Now, if you would care to order your drinks at last," he said, "I will then show you to your table." Zaphod grinned two manic grins, sauntered over to the bar, and bought most of it. Chapter 15. The restaurant at the end of the universe is one of the most extraordinary ventures in the entire history of catering. It has been built on the fragmented remains of...
it will be built on the fragment... That is to say, it will have been built by this time, and indeed has been. One of the major problems encountered in time travel is not that of accidentally becoming your own father or mother. There is no problem involved in becoming your own father or mother that a broad-minded and well-adjusted family can't cope with. There is also no problem about changing the course of history. The course of history does not change because it all fits together like a jigsaw. All the important changes have happened before the things they were supposed to change, and it all sorts itself out in the end. The major problem is quite simply one of grammar. And the main work to consult in this matter is Dr. Dan Streetmentioner's Time Traveller's Handbook of 1001 Tense Formations. It will tell you, for instance, how to describe something that was about to happen to you in the past before you avoided it by time-jumping forward 2 days in order to avoid it. The event will be described differently according to whether you are talking about it from the standpoint of your own natural time, from a time in the further future, or a time in the further past, and is further complicated by the possibility of conducting conversations whilst you are actually travelling from one time to another with the intention of becoming your own mother or father. Most readers get as far as the future semi-conditionally modified subinverted plagial past subjunctive intentional before giving up. And in fact, in later editions of the book, all the pages beyond this point have been left blank to save on printing costs. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy skips lightly over this tangle of academic abstraction, pausing only to note that the term future perfect has been abandoned since it was discovered not to be. To resume. The restaurant at the end of the universe is one of the most extraordinary ventures in the entire history of catering. It is built on the fragmented remains of an eventually ruined planet, which is, Wyolhaven B, enclosed in a vast time bubble and projected forward in time to the precise moment of the end of the universe. This is, many would say, impossible. In it, guests take, will and on take, their places at table and eat, will and on eat, sumptuous meals whilst watching, willing watchin, the whole of creation explode around them. This, many would say, is equally impossible. You can arrive, mayen arriven on when, for any sitting you like, without prior, late for when, reservation, because you can book retrospectively, as it were, when you return to your own time. You can have on book haventer for when presuning returning wenter retro home. This is, many would not insist, absolutely impossible. At the restaurant you can meet and dine with, mayen meeten con with dinen on when, a fascinating cross-section of the entire population of space and time. This, it can be explained patiently, is also impossible. You can visit it as many times as you like, mayen on visit re on visiting, and so on. For further tense correction, consult Dr. Streetmentioner's book. And be sure of never meeting yourself, because of the embarrassment this usually causes. This, even if the rest were true, which it isn't, is patently impossible, say the doubters. All you have to do is deposit one penny in a savings account in your own era, and when you arrive at the end of time, the operation of compound interest means that the fabulous cost of your meal has been paid for. This, many claim, is not merely impossible, but clearly insane, which is why the advertising executives of the star system of Bastablon came up with this slogan. If you've done 6 impossible things this morning, why not round it off with breakfast at Milliways, the restaurant at the end of the universe?